Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 27th, 2006, and today's session is entitled Biblical Jubilee, What Is It? Presented by Dan Erlander, number ERD 2006-04. Let's listen in.
Day of Jubilee, and I'll just read two from Fred Niedner, three other wisdom sayings, and then after that, we're going to start the day by singing Jubilee.
I'm motioning a person.
Well, you should have everyone's attention.
We're ready for the big speech now.
Traffic control.
Let's see, here's one. There is a fine line between hobby and mental illness. This is a good one. If you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything. If you lend someone $20 and never see that person again, it was probably worth it. Give a man a fish and he can eat two meals a day. Now, teach him how to fish and he will sit in a boat and drink beer all day. I guess that's it for today. Someone gave me a book that teaches way to achieve inner peace. Among other things, it says the way to achieve inner peace is to finish all the things you've started. Let's begin our Jubilee this morning with our musician, and it's going to lead us in a song, and I think we have to know one word, is that right?
Jubilee. That's the main one. O Lordy is the other one. So this is a spiritual. It's called Jubilee, and the story behind it is that when Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, that was good news for the slaves, but bad news for the slaveholders, and so there was an active, I suppose you could call it kind of a new suppression campaign going on. And it took a couple of years for the news to get out to Texas. The word is.
Careful now.
Just telling you what I know.
I'm not making your hands at the door.
Well, the story goes that when the news reached the slaves in West Texas, it happened somewhere between June 11th and June 19th. There's plenty of discrepancy. And so there's a big celebration called Juneteenth that is part of the African-American tradition. And this is one of the songs that comes out of that tradition. It's Jubilee. It's a song of freedom. I'll sing a line, and then I invite you to sing it after me. Jubilee, Jubilee, oh Lordy.
Jubilee, Jubilee. Jubilee, Jubilee, oh
do.
Oh, Lordy.
But tell all my friends I'm a coming too.
Oh,
before Jubilee, we'll now start. This is our fourth session of the week. We're taking a break from baptism today because it is Jubilee Day, and this is Dan Erlander. Okay, we're ready. Jubilee. For background of Jubilee, we have to go back to the Exodus that we talked about yesterday, of crossing the Red Sea. The Egyptians stuck in the mud, freedom on the other side, Miriam with her tambourine singing the songs of freedom. So that's where we'll begin today with this story again. So I don't know why I have, let's start with the second one that is Exodus 2, 7 and 8, and then the other one.
Then his sister, that's Moses' sister, said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Yes." So the girl went and called the child's mother.
That's totally the wrong verse.
Yeah.
which is my fault. But that was a lovely passage. Let's try the other one. Exodus 2, 23 to 25.
Let's hope it's right enough. After a long time, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned under their slavery and cried out. Out of the slavery, their cry for help rose up to God. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God looked upon the Israelites, and God took notice of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. God heard, and God took notice of them. Here is the loving heart of God for this people, who are the descendants of Abraham and Sarah, who are in slavery in Egypt. I'm going to see.
And the Exodus 3, 7, and 8 is, "Then the Lord said, I have observed the misery."
Oh, that's it?
That's it.
Would you read that?
"Then the Lord said, I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites."
Mm-hmm. And notice again, God sees the suffering of the people, hears, and God acts. And that is the beginning of the Jubilee story. I forgot to look up the word Jubilee in a dictionary. What does it mean? Is there a scholar here?
It means ram's horn.
Ram's horn. Thank you.
Shanat Yuval is year of the ram's horn.
Oh, good. So then that was how Jubilee started, isn't it, with the blowing of the ram's horn. And then you knew that Jubilee, probably the only one in your life, if it's every 50 years, the only one in your life that you would celebrate when you hear that horn blowing. Now, the slaves in Egypt, what if, now we know the story of God delivering them, crossing the sea, Miriam's song, and then the Egyptians stuck in the mud, and here is this joyful, joyful people. And this is storytelling now, I picture God looking down upon these people, and they're all happy and they're all rejoicing. And do you remember for some of you or most of you when you had your first child? And here is this just teeny little bundle. Did anybody look at that child and say, "Now what do we do?" back in the old days, you went immediately to Dr. Spock, and I'm sure there's newer books today, then you'd read Dr. Spock. Now, I use this as, this is kind of making God from human terms, but God looking at this people whom God has really birthed a people through the water, birth water, through the water of the Red Sea, and now God looks down and says, "Now what do I do?" Now, one thing God could have done is get them right to the Promised Land. If you've been over in that part of the world, from Cairo to Jerusalem is about, 200 miles, maybe. It would take, you could get on the tour bus early in the morning, have lunch, and be there by late afternoon, or maybe early evening. So why didn't God figure out some way? Even walking, I figured it would only take about 2 months. And then add, if you had a bunch of animals, let's say 3 months to get there. Why 40 years? Why 40 years? And here's my answer. The only way they knew that people would live together and be organized was the Egypt way. So they would go to the Promised Land and they would do the only thing they knew, the Egypt way. And I have it in this triangle. With God at the top, or the gods of Egypt, who have blessed the Pharaoh, and they have given the power to Pharaoh, and then under Pharaoh is the triangle. On the top are the royal family, and then under that the elites, and the I call them the big deals in the book. And then you have the ordinary citizens, and then you have the slaves. And then on one side you have the priesthood, whose main message is, this is the way God planned it, and this is the way it will always be. That's what priesthood is good for in the system. Then on the other side, you have the army, just in case there might be 3 or 4 people that don't follow or believe the priest. Keep them in line. And so this is the way it is. This is the way it always will be. We've been studying in our economics with John. We have the Dan and John system. And is John here with him?
There.
Oh, there. Is this anything close?
Yeah.
Is it it?
It's really close.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could have lots of different pyramids, but they all have the same basic structure.
Yeah.
So, and John at the top.
Mm-hmm. John at
it's
the
not John Wallace, by the way. It's John the Graft.
But he's my enemy. So, in a way, we can say this is a very, this is normalcy, isn't it? This is it. This is the way it is. And God is saying, this is the only way they know. So, I think I will set up a 40-year classroom in the wilderness to teach them another way to live. A classroom in the wilderness. In order that the skull of the people may be taken off, Egypt removed, and then another system or another way put in. There's a old joke, or kind of a joke, is that Moses said, I'll have no trouble getting the people out of Egypt. It's getting Egypt out of the people. And I heard a contemporary phrase like that when years ago we were in Namibia, when it was still under South Africa. And Karen and I were standing with a Namibian pastor in front of the church. And if you've been to Africa, you know roads where people are just walking and walking and walking for the shopping, then coming back from the shopping, and then the women carrying everything and the man walking behind with nothing. But I remember this, the pastor looking at these people and said to us, we will get South Africa out of Namibia, but will we get South Africa out of the minds of the people?
Out of what?
Out of the minds of the people. So this is an idea of now the wilderness school, and the wilderness school to teach the people another way to be together. Now, anyone here a teacher? How many teachers? Do you ever have a teachable moment where you go off of a lesson plan? And what do you do when that teachable moment comes? Take it. Yeah. You take the opportunity. And I remember when I started at PLU, the students had decided to build a shanty town on Red Square at PLU, and it was quite elaborate. And so the buzz of the whole school was South Africa, and some teachers just went on with their normal plan, and others says, this is a moment when everyone is thinking about that. So we all have these moments where there's a wrong thing to do to keep with the program, and there's a right thing to do. Happened to me once when I was serving a congregation in the outskirts of San Diego, and just happened that Sunday morning, one of these big howling wind brush fires came over the hill. We had windows on that side of the church, and you could see the fire coming over. And I was young then, but people started leaving to hose down their houses during my sermon. And in my mind, I said, I worked hard on this sermon. I just kept preaching. And soon everybody had left. And Karen and I went home and hosed down our house. It's a funny example of seizing the moment. And now What is the moment that Moses seizes? And that is the people are hungry and they're crabby and they're grumpy because they have no food. And they say to Moses, did you bring us out here into the wilderness to die? Back there in Egypt, we were slaves, but at least we had the flesh pots. And if you've been to an Egyptian restaurant, it's still the same. You have the meat pot and the bread, and you dip it in. The flesh pots of Egypt. And then this, excuse me, this is a teachable moment. And the teachable moment happens in the way God provides bread for the people. And what was that bread called?
Manna.
Manna in the wilderness. And now, when the people are hungry, they're in the vulnerable wilderness where they really need each other. Now, the first lesson of the wilderness begins. And that lesson in the manna is, first, the manna falls and we don't know what it is. The people said, what is it? And that's some humor, because the Hebrew meaning of the word manna is, what is it? So they were saying, what is it? And the answer was, what is it? But then, in the way that the people learned to share, each day they went out, a leader of the clan. And the smaller clans, that leader gathered a smaller amount. The larger clans, a larger amount. Brought it back, all ate, and all had enough. So that was the first lesson of the manna. Then, God gives the manna for all, and all share, and all have enough. The second lesson is there were some people that didn't trust that there would be manna tomorrow.
Yeah.
And what did they do?
Hoarded.
And what happened to that manna?
Smell.
Stink. Rot. Maggots. That was a good lesson, wasn't it? These were the original midnight snackers. So that's the next lesson. Hoarding stinks. And then the next lesson, don't ask me how this happened, but there was no manna that fell on the Sabbath. But there was enough. There was enough from the day before. And this was the lesson that God doesn't want us to work all the time, because the meaning of life is not in the gathering and keeping and the storing and the preserving of manna, but the joy and wonder of life is friendship with God and with each other. And God says, I don't want you to work every day, and this is my lesson for you, that you may enjoy what life is really about. Then, so that's the story of the falling of the manna. Now God will continue to teach the people in the wilderness, and we have a hint in Micah and Isaiah of God's plan for what he wants this people to do for the whole world. So if someone would read, or the first Micah 4 and then Isaiah 11.
He shall judge between many peoples and shall arbitrate between strong nations far away. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. But they shall all sit under their own vines and under their own fig trees, and no one shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken.
And then Isaiah 11:6-10.
The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall feed, and the young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The sucking child shall play in the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea. In that day the root of Jesse shall stand as an ensign to the peoples. Him shall the people seek, and his dwelling shall be glorious.
Mm-hmm. In the Micah passage, was there the verse, did I leave it out, or was it there, about the nations coming to Zion?
Oh, we did.
What?
Oh, yeah, that was 2.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's see. People shall stream to it, and many nations shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem.
Okay. That's, yeah. Now, here we have a picture of a dream of God. And the dream, the final dream is for peace on earth. And what the picture is here, that these people will learn the wilderness lesson. They'll go to their land and put the wilderness lesson into practice, meaning living as wilderness people when they are landed. And then they will live at peace with each other because they're living in justice, in the sharing of everything with each other. And then the nations around them that are constantly in warfare will kind of stand there on their tiptoes and look at this people and say, wow, look how they live. Look at the wonderful way of life that they have and how they are living in peace with each other. Let's go to school. And so instead of attacking Jerusalem, they go to the mountain of the Lord and say, teach us the way of your God. And then this is where it follows. The animals will live together in peace. And no one shall hurt. And then everyone will be under their own fig tree with no one to harm them. Because they've gone to the University of Jerusalem to learn the manna way. And now, so we'll move from there. We're moving towards a jubilee. If you wonder if I got off the track. Okay, the wilderness school continues. The lessons of the wilderness school, some of them, and from the falling of manna, this is from Manna and Mercy, and I didn't bring my copy, so I checked this out of the library. And we own nothing, all is God's, all is gift. Did anyone own the manna?
No.
All is gift. And if you try to make it your own, it stinks. God gives enough for all to be shared by all. Hoarding causes rot. And then what is work? Work is helping God distribute manna, the gift God promises to all. And then last, God gives rest so humans can practice full time what life is all about, and that is friendship with God, with others, and with nature, and with creation. Now, in the wilderness school, now they learn about the three great days. And these are the days that are set aside to practice full-time what life is all about, and then work on the other days or other season is to provide food for everyone so that they may be sustained in order to practice the wonderful rest of first Sabbath day, Sabbath year, and Jubilee. So, let's... I'll just say a word about each of these days, and then we'll get into Jubilee. Sabbath day is which day? Seventh day of the week, and on the Sabbath day, no one will work, and then. This is a day to enjoy God and others and creation. Then the Sabbath year is every seventh year. And this is wonderful because nobody works all year except some of the women who have to prepare food. Nobody works all year. Well, what do they eat? Do you ever not plant a garden and all kinds of stuff comes up anyway? And this was a promise. The land will produce enough for the Sabbath year. And so then the people's rest, the land rests. This is very, very ecological. The land needs rest, as humans need rest for a year, and also the animals need rest. But it's a very connection to animals type of society that is being set up here. Also, it is a society where life is joy. And work is to sustain that life of joy. And some of the others in the wilderness laws that come forth is that when you're married, you get to take a year off from working. Let everybody else feed you. That's fine. Take a year off. You need all the help you can get.
Is that the 7-year itch?
Yeah. And if you're, when a man is married a whole year of not serving in the military, you know, there are all of these different ways of being joyful about life and constantly teaching. That life is about the friendship, not about the manna. God will provide the manna. So now, let's move to the Jubilee year. And that's where we get the word Jubilee. And it's in Leviticus 25, and some parts of the Jubilee are wonderful. Some parts are not, if you are not part of the Hebrew community. Like, it's a wonderful year for freeing slaves, unless you're a slave who is not Hebrew. So, but this is the year of Jubilee. Now, I'll list some of the things about the year of Jubilee, and it's Leviticus 25. And what we have here, John reminded me this morning, this is Hebrew property laws. And now the first is to the Hebrew word for land in Na'ala. And this was when the people entered the land. Before they entered, there were five sermons of Moses, And the theme of all of the sermons is this: when you enter the land, live the way of the wilderness. Be landed wilderness people. And that means when you have land, that the crops that grow, that is the manna given by God. So so now here is some of the parts of the Jubilee. During a 50-year period, people have lost their land because of misfortune or other reasons. And on the 50th year, when the Jubilee horn blows, everybody who lost their land, it is returned to them. Now, the basis of this is Nahala. Each person is given Nahala, meaning the tribes, the smaller tribes receive more land, less land, larger tribes more. And then each family, clan, had their land, but it was called Nahala, and Nahala means you don't own it. It is God's land, and it is given to you and to your family in perpetuity, but it is never owned by you. It is owned by God, and it is like the manna. Just as God poured the manna in the wilderness, now your manna is the crops that grow from this land. However, some, because of misfortune, would lose their Nahala, and another person would add it to theirs. But then, in order that they're not become a society of the very rich and the very poor, those who exploit, those who are exploited, the Jubilee was that when that horn blows, all the land is returned to the original occupant of that Nahala. Do you get it so far? And then, no wonder it was joyful for many people. But that is a premise that we don't own anything. Is that? I mean, do you believe that?
Amen.
I believe it. Then,
I read chapter 25 several times last night. And in verse 23, it says, "The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine." This is God talking.
Mm-hmm.
"With me, you are but aliens and tents."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And aliens are, it's funny, because God is saying to us, "You are but aliens and tenants. I own the land. You cannot own it in perpetuity."
Yeah.
And I puzzled over that because aliens get a short end of the stick in the rest of the chapter.
I know. But then here God calls God's people, "You are aliens."
Yes.
I wonder what that means. If it means don't ever think that you're landed.
Yes.
On your own land, because it's God's.
And
do you ever look at your property that you have all the papers in the file to prove that you own it? And then I like to picture, if the world lasts 1,000 years from now, will anybody know that I own this little plot of dirt on Whidbey Island? It's God's.
That thought of being aliens and strangers in the land is a lengthy theme. It keeps coming back as God reminds folk, don't forget that you were aliens and strangers in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's over and over, isn't it? Don't forget. Do not forget. And part of the rituals then become a group not forgetting who we are, whose we are. One interesting thing, this is archaeologically, but did they keep this when they become landed? And it's thinking of the New Testament scholar Ron Sider at Eastern Baptist Seminary, I think, has done this archaeological work. And the years after they entered the land, which is called the primitive Israel, or it's called the time of the judges, from that period, the archaeology shows a very equal type of home. You don't have any large estates. I mean, they had many faults, of course, during that year, but they kept this understanding. And then you lived in a village, and then your nahala was, you walked to your nahala. They didn't have a house on each farm. So now look how this land is like the manna in the wilderness. What about the vulnerable, the widows and the orphans and the sojourners? And sojourners especially, this was before motels, hotels, restaurants, fast food. It was very, very vulnerable to be a traveler through a foreign land. And so there's all these different ways that first you remind yourself it is God's land and not mine. One of them was that you never cut your crops all the way up to the stone wall, but you left crops around like the wheat. And this was God's manna for the sojourners and for the widows and for the orphans. I give food for all, and you will be my partner in distributing the food for all, so no one is hungry. The same way with a fruit tree, you're only allowed to shake it so many times. The rest is for the animals. The rest is for the birds. My brother in Oregon, who is a subsistence garden counterculture person, still is, but he made a deal with the animals and the birds about his fruit, you know, that they could have as much as they want if they would leave some for him.
How did he teach him that?
Well, he has a special kind of, you know, there are some people that have, you preach to them, like Francis. I don't know, but he said he always seemed to have enough. You know, this wouldn't always be the case, but this was the principle that God gives enough for all. Now, also, some more things about Jubilee, and then we will talk about it a little. All property is returned. If you buy property from someone during the 50-year period, you only pay for the number of harvests left until the Jubilee. So you're really buying harvests and not land. Then the land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. And this is God saying, and with me you are but aliens and tenants. That's what we just heard. Then there are all kinds of little details about this that I won't go into. But then in lending, there will be no interest. And what if someone sells themselves to you as a slave, someone that is in such a desperate situation that it becomes your slave? And this is one thing that's unfair to the outsider. If you're a Hebrew slave, then when the Jubilee horn blows, then you are free. Not only free, but the person for whom you work is responsible to get you set up for a sustainable life. But there can be slaves from surrounding people or aliens who are not covered by Jubilee. I wonder who made that up. Now, then, so these are just some of the parts of Jubilee. I maybe have left some out. But in the wilderness, you know, there was a giving of the covenant, which were the laws that would be kept as a matter of joy, and then the Ten Commandments, and then, the other one was, do not muzzle the ox that treadeth on the grain. And this was used to be used by pastors to try to get salary increases. What it really means was the love for the animals, you know. And notice how Jesus followed these ways, you know, also the people did at that time. If an animal falls into a hole on the Sabbath, what do? The animal out. Then muzzling the ox was a way of keeping the ox from eating while the ox is working. Come on. Yeah. Let him eat. Yeah. Let the ox eat. Do not muzzle the ox that treads on the grain. God's manna is for all, both the animals and the humans. Anybody think of any other things? There's other things that I've left out of this. Oh, I was going to continue with the archaeology. The archaeology after the coming of the kings, when all of this ended, or not, maybe not all of it, but it. Then we have the digging up of palatial homes of the wealthy landowners who have taken over the land of the poor, added it field to field, house to house. This is when it's obvious that no thought or there are excuses, self-justifications. And now, let's talk about it a while now, and then I want to close with Jesus.
So, how long did that last? They did live.
That's really a big discussion among scholars that goes all the way from they never really did it to they did it but but you know humans. it was more of a vision and a dream than reality. We know from the time of Judges that they definitely influenced the way people lived in a form of equality. But we don't know. But there was something about it that was unattractive to the human desire. I wish we knew more about that.
But what about Jews now? How do they just disregard, or do they disregard this?
Yeah, because the understanding of land in the Old Testament was that the way we share this land will be the reason that the nations come to us and say, teach us how to live with each other. What we seldom hear about is the people in the Jewish community that still hold the vision. And these are the ones that in Israel were even against Israel becoming a nation. They would include who some of the great Jewish theologians of our past years. What's that?
Martin Buber.
Yeah, and then there's my mind is blank. But there were the voices that say, and this is still held by some of the most orthodox Jewish people, you know, that don't even accept Israel as this is not the vision that God had for this people. Yeah, so it's a thin tradition but still, and there's a Jewish peace movement in Israel that we, again, seldom hear about. And they would hold this sense that we are to be a light to the nations, for the nations to see how to live with each other. So, and they need our prayers because they never get any publicity.
I'd like to reiterate that. I met some friends at college who were either American Jews who have ties to Israel or are native Israelis who are completely against the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land and who are Jews and Israelis working for peace in the Middle East, with peace with the Palestinians, and a fair deal for the Palestinians.
I have a question. How does, with God providing, how does tithing in today's economic situations tie in? And with something God taught us, my wife and I, 20 years ago, that 90% of our money will go farther than 100%.
Yeah, tithing.
And God provides. And
That was the second most important thing to share with you. I forgot. Because that was so much a part of this wilderness, was teaching the people to tithe. Now, tithing in the original law was different than what we call tithing today. It was the first fruits of the crop, the first and therefore the best, goes to the Lord as a reminder to us that we don't own any of it. So as a way of reminding ourselves and teaching ourselves, you know, we are knuckleheads, and teaching ourselves that I don't own this, that was every year you bring the first tenth to before the temple, the worship area after to the temple. Now, what is carefully hidden from people about the tithe in our church stewardship campaigns is that you brought the tithe every year to the temple, and two out of those 3 years you stayed at the temple and used your tithe to invite all of your family and your friends, and you would put your tithe food together and have an absolutely fabulous feast and eat your entire tithe. Now, what did this teach? What did this teach people? That God just wants you to remember that God is God, and now you have the example of God giving back. That's the best way I can think of saying it. And then the third year, you brought your tithe, and then that was for the sojourner, the widows and orphans, and widows and sojourners. And so then a third of the tithe each year, because you rotated among three groups of people. So every year, the tithe for the sojourners, the poor, widows and orphans. So there was enough. I always like to try to think of a stewardship campaign that would run that way. Yeah. Think of the potlucks. And my parents taught me to tithe, and it's been a practice all of my life. I've known there have been people who tithe that go broke. You know, this the idea that if you tithe, automatically God will bless you with riches. It was a way of telling myself, again, by giving the best and the first, that I don't own it. I give this back to the one who owns all of it, God. Anything else you want to share about that?
It's been a great blessing, that's all I can say.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And any other?
I'm thinking about the Vet's Feast. I'm wondering if it was a tithe or a jubilee. Babette's Feast.
Oh, Babette's Feast.
Yeah, she, if, for those that haven't seen the movie, she was a poor person working, and she saved and saved for years and years. And finally, what she did at the end was, I think they're all Lutherans, actually. Yeah. She brought all these fancy foods from Paris and fed all of her friends.
She won the lottery.
She took everything she had and gave it to her, to everyone.
And she gave everything, didn't she, for these pious dames. And they were born again. What an example that she is, and the joy. And as a friend back there mentioned, the blessings do come back. She was the happiest person on earth, having given away all. Any other?
And I missed some of the point in terms of, you know, how much was this practiced once they wound up in the promised land.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my understanding is that it really wasn't practiced. But it really was quite impractical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, talking about the whole Jubilee, all the dimensions of the year of Jubilee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the best thing to say, it always stands as a vision of what life can be as people of faith in God. And I would be very surprised if it was never tried, maybe in limited ways. Now, I have the last 3 minutes to tell Jesus' restoration of the Jubilee. And that is Luke 4:18-19.
The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, proclaim the year of the Lord's favor.
Yeah. Now, the phrase there, proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, when Jesus read this passage out of Isaiah, the biblical scholars, I don't think I've ever read one that disagrees with this, that the year of the Lord's favor was a Jubilee. And Jesus announcing in the synagogue of Nazareth, he says, I am restoring a Jubilee. So now look how Jesus did restore Jubilee. Of course, first in his own life, but then in the life of the early community in Acts. Jubilee is restored, meaning that the people that had extra houses gave to those who had none. The people who had too much gave, so everyone was fed. Feeding, as I said the other day, got so carried away that the Roman emperor said, they're not only feeding their own poor, they're feeding ours as well. And it was restored, but not in an agricultural setting. That's what's so very interesting about the book of Acts, that the early Christian community was basically not rural, except for Galatians, would probably be an exception. But these were cities and city folks. And so now what the early Christian community does in these cities is figure out a way to restore Jubilee in an urban setting. And that's what we have in the book of Acts as it starts in Jerusalem. All the widows and orphans are taken care of. Those who have excess land give so the others may have land or houses they talked about, not, and it's interesting in Leviticus, houses in a stone city were exempt from Jubilee. But now the houses in the city of the first Christians, if you had excess, you would sell it and give it to feed the poor. And the idea was sustainability, and enough is enough. And those who had extra, that was the manna that was meant for other people. And so it's interesting to follow Jesus' promise in Luke of restoring the Jubilee. And no doubt those people were very excited about this because many of them had lost their land, because the most un-Jubilee time in Jewish history was the time of Jesus, maybe. And they were excited. That's why in Man and Mercy, I have one person listening to the sermon saying, wow, sounds like land reform. They adapted the Jubilee to their setting. And that lasted for a while. But again,
about how long did that social system really persist?
I'm just guessing, but probably in different ways. Until the time of Constantine, probably, and when the church becomes a power in the Roman Empire. But it's interesting to read the readings of ancient people who were not Christians talking about these Christians, how weird they are in terms of giving and generosity and taking care of the weak and the vulnerable. Well, this is Jubilee, and the reason I think the word Jubilee is such a happy word is that finally everything that we've talked about before is in biblical thinking, it's God's way for our human happiness and our human joy. And God wants us to be joyful. And part of that is a gift of the Sabbath and the Sabbath year and the Jubilee. So rejoice and let's celebrate today.
Does that include loopers?
Yeah, that includes. Yeah, but don't get your hands up past your shoulders.